Well, we come to the second Sunday, the last Sunday of our 8 days of explaining something of the Christian faith under the title, But I Know a Man Who Can, and we come to perhaps the strangest of our choices, a politician, the Governor Pilate. And I think you'll find it a big help to have open in front of you the passage that Brenda read to us earlier. If you've one of the church Bibles, it's on page 107 in the New Testament sections. It's John chapter 18. I want to speak this morning especially to those who are making up their minds about Jesus, because I believe that's one of the reasons why this whole scene before Pilate is included in John's Gospel. Oh, it's there, of course, first of all, because it happened. Even the Roman historian Tacitus in his annals writes, Christus suffered the extreme penalty at the hands of Pontius Pilate. It's there, of course, like all of John's Gospel, because it has an important truth to teach us about Jesus. It'll explain for us who he was and who he was not. But it's hard to read through chapters 18 and 19 without also coming to the conclusion that John has included it, because there are lessons for us to learn from Pilate himself. All of us are faced with Pilate's decision. What will we do with Jesus? John, as he writes his gospel, is aware of those who will be reading through it. And he knows they must come to some decision. When you read God's word or when you hear it, why, at the end, we either take a step towards Jesus or a step away from him. And, of course, although it is Jesus technically who's on trial in these chapters, actually we realize that whatever verdict Pilate comes to about Jesus doesn't really alter our view of Jesus of Nazareth. But we judge Pilate by his verdict. Long after everything else you've done is forgotten, this decision that you and I make about Jesus of Nazareth will stand. So come and examine how Pilate handles the whole issue. And meet, first of all, an embarrassed politician, which always brings a smile to our lips, doesn't it? Somehow or other, we like to see them, for once, put on the rack. Occasionally, you can see it on the telly, if Robin Day has got one of his more barbed comments in. Just occasionally, the studio audience manage it and get them rattled. Well, Pilate is like that, and as we read of him and see him turning from the Jewish leaders to Jesus himself, to the crowd, as he pops in and out of his praetorium, he seems to be like some kind of scalded cat. Throughout, he's under pressure. He's a skilled politician, but he's on the defensive from the word go. He's not set the agenda at all. To begin with, it all happens early, and that's rarely the best time of day for any of us. Look at verse 28. Then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the praetorium. It was early. Yes, the cock had only just crowed before they set off for Pilate's. He's hardly got out of his pajamas. He's halfway through his muesli, not reached the second cup of coffee, not finished the crossword, and there's some case he's urgently needed to deal with. It's actually a moment of truth for him. His career is going to hang on it. So is his eternity. Then again, we discover quickly that he's actually forced to take the case. They themselves did not enter the praetorium, we read, so that they might not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Almost everything about the case is guaranteed to work, Pilate. There's an odd religious scruple that meant he had to go out to them. So Pilate went out to them and said, What accusation do you bring against this man? And they answered him, and they're maddeningly imprecise over details, aren't they? They answered him, If this man were not an evildoer, we would not have handed him over. Well, you don't get a better catch-all charge than this, do you? It reflects the difficulty that the Jewish religious leaders had in getting any evidence together against Jesus. So Pilate says to them, he trusts his first judgment and instinct, take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. We'll discover that he's actually endlessly trying to pass the buck, but like a boomerang, it keeps coming back. Now, you can't blame him first thing in the morning for wanting to do that, can you? He's sending it back to the magistrate's court, but the Jews said to him, it's not lawful for us to put any man to death. He discovers the prosecution are calling for the death sentence, and the execution is demanded, even though no charge has been laid. And then John inserts one of these little verses just to remind us of exactly what's going on. This, he says, was to fulfill the word which Jesus had spoken, to show by what death he was to die. Yes, Jesus has always claimed that in the end he would be lifted up. And John is reminding us that that death, that cross that he'll be executed on, is no accident. It's quite deliberate. Whoever or whatever look as if they're in control, it is actually God's plan that's being developed. And against Pilate's wishes, against his first and best endeavors, he is forced to take the case. He faces his moment of truth. Pilate entered the praetorium again and called Jesus. He's forced to face Jesus of Nazareth. Pilate's a Roman. He has no interest in Jewish religious squabbles, but like it or not, this is his moment. He seems, by all accounts, to have despised Jews, and yet here's Jesus, a Jew. He was a religious cynic. I suppose he might have turned up on Remembrance Day or at some occasional civic carol service, but otherwise he wouldn't have been interested. It's quite a contrast with the man we were studying last Sunday morning, if you were with us. Then we looked at Nicodemus, who came willingly to Jesus. This week, we meet a man, Pilate, who probably wouldn't have touched him with a barge pole, but he's forced to. Unexpectedly, reluctantly. Yes, but God has brought Pilate to his moment of truth. And it will be like that for some of us. Some come willingly to explore the truth or otherwise about Jesus of Nazareth. Others aren't quite sure. Maybe you're not really quite sure why you're here this morning. It wasn't a deliberate policy of examining the case. You just had some nagging friend you had to get off your back. Or perhaps there's some crisis that's driven you here. Tragedies sometimes do that, as they become life-shattering experiences. So actually do great joys. Many of my friends who are in the ministry tell me that it's often when people have their first child, and they're brought face to face with the wonder of some new creation and the responsibility, that they start to ask questions they never asked before. Well, whether you've come eagerly, unexpectedly, reluctantly, God has brought us to a moment of truth this morning. We'll have to sit where that embarrassed politician sat. An embarrassed politician. Secondly, he discovers an innocent king. This is the paragraph from verses 33 to 38. It's the little paragraph which is the core of the whole trial. Here is Pilate's great opportunity, face to face, to discover what this Jesus is all about. And John includes it so that we too understand very clearly who Jesus is. And the thread of innocence runs through it from the very first words. Verse 33, Pilate entered the praetorium again and called Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? Yes, that is the emphasis in the original. It's a question of surprise. He's called the prisoner to the dock, and as Jesus gets up, he looks at him and does a double take. It's the most unlikely looking revolutionary he's seen. All that kind of talk is clearly ridiculous to him. The threat to Pilate is diminishing by the moment. And Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Is this your question, Pilate, or have you been put up to it? You see, Jesus is not naive. Actually, he can outplay the politicians at their own game if they want it. And we can be over glib at times, can't we? We can be asked to say, as interviewers often do, we can be asked to give one of those yes-no answers to questions that don't have it. And Jesus is saying to Pilate, look, let's define our terms. Is this your question? Am I a king of the Jews? Is this a Roman question? With all that that implies about the Romans' understanding of a king, if you're asking if I'm a political king, the answer will be no. Or did others say it to you about me? Are you echoing the high priest's question? Because if they're accusing me of being a king, well, it's wrapped up with other connotations. It's got the idea of God's Messiah behind it. And corrupted though that title and the expectations of the Messiah had become, there is a truth there. Yes, if it's a spiritual king you're asking about, well then you'd get a different answer. Did you say this of your own accord? Or did others say it to you about me? Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Certainly not. Your own nation and the chief priests has handed you over to me. What have you done?" And Jesus answered, and look at this answer, "My kingship is not of this world." Says that three times in this verse. My kingship is not of this world. If my kingship were of this world, my servants would fight that I might not be handed over to the Jews. But my kingship is not from this world. He could hardly make those points clearer, could he? Whatever you make of Jesus, he is crystal clear about this. He is not a political revolutionary. And although there are people who've always longed to try and dress him up as that, and explain him away and his death away in those terms, they do so in the face of all the evidence and all the transcripts we possess of his trial. My kingship, he says, is not of this world. And I'm not fighting to preserve it. Pilate said to him, "So you are a king." It's amazing, once people have got an idea in their mind, how they can never let go of it. And Jesus answered, "You say that I'm a king." Well, they're your words, not mine. But if you must use it, well, I'm a very different king from others, he's saying. They depend on the power of their loyal servants who would fight for them. Might is right, defends most kingships, but mine is based on truth. And he says these very telling words, "For this I was born, and for this I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth." Jesus says his whole ministry, his whole life revolves around this point, to reveal the truth. John's been telling us that throughout his book. Right at the outset he says, "The true light that enlightens every man was coming into the world." You want to know the truth about ourselves, about individuals, about why we tick the way we do, why we don't tick when we thought we might? We must come to him. Want to know the truth about our world and what's happening and what it's destined for? He came to reveal it. Supremely. If I want to know the truth about God, about the spiritual world and God's kingdom and God's heaven, Well, this is where you'll find it, says Jesus. This is where you'll find the truth. For this I was born, for this I've come into the world to bear witness to the truth. Now please take that on board and you'll understand why totalitarian states the world over always crack down on Christians, won't you? Whether it's China or Eastern Europe or Nepal, there is an allegiance involved to this Jesus that'll defy any state mind. Yes, there's King's claims implicit here, but do understand its nature. It's not in the narrow sense of the word political at all. But it is staggering. Look how verse 37 finishes. For this I was born, for this I've come into the world to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Try and take it in. It is an outrageous, intolerable statement. Jesus of Nazareth does not say everyone who is of the truth hears God's voice. He says, hears my voice. And when he talks about hearing, he doesn't just mean listening. We've got a marvelous way of thinking which allows us to listen to something and then do nothing about it. But that's not listening in New Testament language. No, it means everyone who's of the truth listens to me and acts on it, obeys me. If I'm not listening to and acting on Jesus of Nazareth, if I'm not obeying him, says Jesus, I'm not of the truth. If I want to ask myself the question, am I of the truth? The answer is, do you listen to Jesus of Nazareth and act on what you hear? And Pilate said to him, what is truth? And if the question's meant to mean simply, well, give us the details of this truth you've come to bear witness to, then it's a fair question, isn't it? What did Jesus reveal? What did he bear witness to? Those are questions we must all go on asking day after day after day. That's fine to ask it, but if you're going to ask that question, then don't run away like Pilate did. After he'd said this, he went out. You know, indeed, part of this whole 8 days has been to make sure people ask that kind of question and to give them opportunity to find the answers. That's why we've got on offer today a number of these copies of John's Gospel. They'll be on a table at the back. Do take one. Read it. Do indeed fill in those cards you were given on your way in, which allows you to go to join others in thrashing out what the answers to that kind of question is. If the question means, what are the details that you came to reveal? Well, I guess it's a fair question. If it's questioning the origin of truth, if Pilate's saying, now, that's all very well what you say, but I mean, you know, how do we know what truth is? How can we find it? Then, of course, understand that is questioning Jesus fundamentally. That is denying him his rightful kingship. That is flying in the face of the sentence he's just issued. Because he said, for this I was born, and for this I've come into the world to bear witness to the truth. It's no good saying, well, yes, but what is truth? How can we know what it is? Without thinking you're turning your back on Jesus. There's a student at a relatively recent mission who'd heard something about Jesus, who at the end of what he'd heard said he wanted to know more about it and signed up to take it further. And when someone came round and said to him, now, what can we do to help you explore further? Would you like to join a group that'll look into some of the issues? He said, no, he didn't want to investigate like that. He thought that actually he ought to investigate all the faiths, and it wasn't fair just to look at Christianity or Jesus on his own. At first sight, it's a plausible answer. It's slightly ironic that he was a medic. He's spending 6 years of his life studying medicine, which is a little unfair on history and economics and Russian literature and pure maths. Now, at first sight, it's a plausible answer. It's just conceivable. He'll investigate all of them, though most people who speak like that actually want to investigate none. But I want us to understand that in many ways, that kind of an answer is a denial of Jesus. I'm not trying to say we should never open a Quran, we should never study what other faiths believe. What I am saying is this, at least what Jesus seems to be saying very clearly in verse 37 is this, isn't it? That if I've come face to face with Jesus, and I then speak as if I have to look around for truth and treat him as just one of many options, why, then I'm denying his whole ministry. Because he was born. He came into the world to bear witness to the truth. I've turned my back on Jesus of Nazareth. And Pilate said, "What is truth?" Whether he was wistful or just busy, I wish we had time to go into that, but not really much time for philosophy. There's all this paperwork to get onto. Anyway, whatever happened, he didn't want the answer. After he'd said this, he went out to the Jews again. There were no further questions for the prisoner. He'd got all he thought he needed. He had no doubts. Here was an innocent king, whatever kind of king he might be. He told the Jews, "I find no crime in him." An embarrassed politician. He may not understand what kind of king he has in front of him, but one thing is clear, this man is innocent. And yet, having got that far, Pilate takes up an impossible position. Now, do notice, I did not say he found himself in an impossible position. He wasn't in anything of the kind, but he took up an impossible position. Pilate won't listen to Jesus' voice. He won't hear and do. And if we're like that, we'll discover ourselves in much the same boat as he found himself. It led to some tragic consequences. It led firstly to an appalling injustice. Look again at verse 38. He went and told them, "I find no crime in him." And then he manages to go on, verse 39, "But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. Will you have me release for you the king of the Jews?" This man is innocent. I traditionally release a criminal on this day. Shall I release this innocent one? You can almost understand them crying out for Barabbas, can't you? I mean, they might as well get a proper criminal if they're going to have someone released on the day. You find the appalling injustice. Again, verse 38, "I find no crime in him." Chapter 19, verse 1, "Then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him." See, that's what happens. If you won't crucify Jesus as a revolutionary king, but won't acknowledge him as the king of truth and release him, when people want to say that Jesus was just a good teacher, that's roughly what they're doing. They're scourging him. It's the one conclusion to which the evidence cannot possibly point. But we daren't convict him as a fraud, and we won't have him as our king. Or you'll find again, verse 12 of chapter 19, Pilate seeks to release Jesus. But the Jews cried out, "If you release this man, you're not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king sets himself against Caesar." And when Pilate heard these words, he handed Jesus over to them to be crucified. He knew he was innocent. He sought to release him. But for Pilate, the fear of man, the mockery, the threat to his position, it was very vulnerable. He'd made a fair hash of the job so far. One more report back to the emperor, and he'd probably lost it. It was a very awkward moment for him to have to make this kind of decision. If only it could have been in other circumstances. And Pilate makes these dreadful injustices. But then the fear of man always challenges our fear of God. It's always an awkward moment for us to decide. There are always those friends who probably won't take it too well. Sometimes they're closer home than that, aren't they? It's husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend. There's always the job, the career. It rarely looks as if it'll enhance our career to become Christian. So we fudge. You may have to drag condemnation of Jesus out of us, but we won't release him. There are thousands of Pilates around. Suspect I meet them most weeks. Now, this impossible position he takes up leads to an appalling injustice. It leads, secondly, to frightening silence. Chapter 19, verse 7. Pilate's had Jesus flogged. He's produced him, hoping that'll do. The Jews are shouting that he should be crucified. And then they say, we have a law, and by that law he ought to die, because he's made himself the Son of God. And when Pilate heard these words, he was the more afraid. He entered the praetorium again and said to Jesus, where are you from? But Jesus gave no answer. Doesn't that strike you as strange? Jesus gave no answer. Pilate's heard it straight from their lips. This man's claiming to be the Son of God. He's not unnaturally afraid. Anyone would think twice before convicting a prisoner with that claim on their lips. So he rushes back and asks the most vital question, where are you from? And Jesus gave no answer. Isn't that deeply disturbing? See, Jesus, who is so patient when teaching the disciples, who so often seem so thick and painfully slow, now gives no answer. It's worth looking at the people in the Bible that Jesus never answers. And they're all triflers. They're all those who are trifling with the truth. The Pharisees say, by what authority do you do these things? And Jesus says, well, tell you what, let me ask you one first. By what authority did John the Baptist come? They have to hold an instant committee meeting. And they weigh up the options. Well, they say, we either say that he was just an ordinary man, in which case we're in trouble with the crowd because they thought he was a prophet. Or we say that John the Baptist came from God, in which case we're in trouble with Jesus, because his next question, they're like chess players, they can see the next move ahead. His next question is, well, if he was a prophet from God, why didn't you obey him? We're stuck either way. So they go back and they say, we've considered this and we don't think we can answer that question. So Jesus says, well, I can't answer yours either. I'm not playing games. You're obviously not ready to go where the truth leads you. Or there's Herod. Herod gets Jesus in the middle of the trial. Herod gets his chance to ask questions about Jesus. He's always been interested in religious things. He had the Baptist preaching for him time and time again. Loved it. Apart from the bit when the Baptist kept telling him he had to get rid of his mistress. Otherwise, it was fine. Of course, he never did anything about it. And in the end, he found himself having to cut off the Baptist's head. So he comes to see Jesus, and he asks him his questions, and he wants some signs from Jesus, and he gets not a word. And Pilate gets no answer either, because he's not going to obey it. So Jesus won't waste his breath. See, we often talk as if it's the evidence that's so confusing about this decision on Jesus. That wasn't Pilate's problem. And it's very rarely ours. It's following where the evidence leads us. Come across example after example. This week someone was saying only the other day, Very honestly, they admitted, now their problem with Jesus of Nazareth is that they were too proud. Too proud to bow the knee to him. Well, the Pharisees were too proud. It would have reversed all their religious thinking. Herod was too proud. It would have meant losing his mistress. Pilate was too proud. It would have meant, as a politician, he'd have lost his seat. This is the judgment, John says, that the light has come into the world, but men prefer darkness to light because their deeds are evil. Jesus gave him no answer. It's very disturbing. You see, our picture is so often of plenty of opportunities, of a God who's always only too pleased to oblige when we decide we'll ask him our questions. It wasn't like that with Pilate. He had his opportunity. He refused to follow it. He got no answer. You'll search for me and find me, says God, when you search for me with all your heart. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Well, today there are some of us, I suspect, who need to pray to God that Pilate's is not our heart. To pray to God that in his mercy he'd grant us one more opportunity for the truth. Take that John's Gospel at the end and go home and read it. If you possibly can, join that Discovering Christianity group. Fill it in, the friend who invited you will tell you what to do. Put it in a bin at the back. Find out the truth before it's too late. Because the last tragedy of this impossible position Pilate adopted is that he found himself on an invisible fence. He adopts my favourite position, which is astride the fence. I don't know about you, but there are many decisions that I hate making. If it's possible to sit on the fence on them, I will. But the message of John is that you can't. And take the warning from Pilate. He's a master of the game. Watching him trying to sit on the fence is like watching a genius at work. If you study all the gospel accounts, it's something like 9 or 10 times that he attempts it. And John just gives us a sample. You judge him, he says at the beginning. And they say, no, we want the death sentence. Discovers he's a Galilean. He says, oh, right, marvelous. If he's a Galilean, send him to Herod. He'll deal with him. Herod sends him back. Well, who shall I release, Jesus or Barabbas? They choose the murderer. Well, I've had him flogged. Will that do? No, crucify him, they say. Well, I'll release him anyway. No, crucify him, they say. So he comes onto the judgment seat. And you remember how Matthew records it? He gets out that basin and washes his hands of the affair. And of course he can't. History has pointed the finger at him right down the centuries. The one thing anyone knows about Pontius Pilate, if they know only one thing, is that Jesus was crucified under Pontius Pilate. He's a master of the art, but if he can't sit on the fence, then you and I can't. Here is one of those questions that demand a yes-no answer. It's agony to some of us who are all too aware of Jesus' innocence and his goodness. We don't want to say no to Jesus. We're too full of admiration and respect to want to say no to Jesus. But our King? That's another matter. So we scramble for the fence. We do it in lots of different ways. We describe Jesus as fulsomely as we can. I went to the other week to Alec McCowan's recital of Mark's Gospel down in the East End. Here's Alec McCowan in the program notes. Learning St. Mark was a revelation of an extraordinary man, of extraordinary events, of extraordinary hope. Whether or not you're a believer, it's impossible to study St. Mark carefully and not know without any shadow of doubt that something amazing happened in Galilee 2,000 years ago. Well, those are gracious words, aren't they? But to the very best of my knowledge, McCowan is an unbeliever. He's actually saying no. Or we scramble for the fence, not so much by describing Jesus. We avoid that subject altogether. We just describe the event itself. At the interval, an hour into hearing Mark's gospel, McCowan, in his brilliant way, had recited these extraordinary deeds. Quite astonishing. And when he walked off stage, the couple behind me, one of them turned to the other and said, "Well, what did you make of that?" And my big ears were flapping instantly. I wanted to know what they did make of it. And I thought, yes, what had they made of this? Were they going to say, "Oh, it's all rubbish, you can't believe a word of it"? Or were they bowled over by this character striding around Galilee? "What did you make of that?" And the friend replied, "Marvelous memory he must have." Well, you've heard it, haven't you? You've come away from the sermon and you've said to your friend, "What did you think of that?" And he said, "Good speaker." You won't be able to say that this morning. But when you do, understand it's just a polite way of saying no. Anything to avoid the word no we'll come to. As many of you know, we've had a series of evenings this week where people have come and we've had a delicious supper. And afterwards I've said something about Jesus. And I've been on the door saying goodbye to people as they left. And it's been interesting to watch people's reactions when they've given them away. There was one person who came up to me and he walked right up. As he was shaking hands, we were virtually nose to nose as he stared me in the eyes and he said, "The food was very good." It was the politest put down I had all week. And one of the firmest. One of the most civilized snubs I think I've ever received. But I only hope that he understood under that politeness he was also snubbing Jesus. We have to get off the fence. It does not exist except in our imagination. Some questions require yes-no answers, don't they? Think of the time I stood at a set of chancel steps with Claire beside me. And the minister said to me, "Will you take this woman to be your wife?" Well, you've only two answers to that question, really, haven't you? I could have said, "Well, she's an extraordinary woman." Wouldn't have done. I could have said, "I must say you put that very well, Vicar." Or I could have licked my lips and said, "Well, I'm sure the reception will be very good." But I don't think she'd have hung around. "Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." It's time to be off the fence. It's time to listen and obey. If that's you this morning, then make sure before you leave you pick up this little booklet. It's called Start a New Life. I'll be at the table at the back there. Just ask me for one or grab it from the table. It'll tell you precisely how to get off the fence. Again, come along to these groups that are mentioned here. Just fill in the form. If you can't make the evenings that are suggested, leave those blank and we'll get in touch and see how we can help. Tear it off and shove it in one of the bins at the back. Now, don't be a pilot. "Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice, listens, obeys." Let's pray. God, thank you for one more warning, one more encouragement to grasp your good news and make Jesus our King. Our Heavenly Father, as some will see all too clearly the shame, the inconvenience, the embarrassment of following Jesus, grant courage this morning that they might say, "I will," might confess their rebellion, know your pardon, rejoice in your kingship. Have mercy on us, we pray. Amen.